This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Ted Danson, became famous for portraying an iconic TV character, the shallow, vain, womanizing bartender on the long-running NBC sitcom Cheers. But he hasn't stopped there. He did some great work recently on the drama series Damages, playing a corrupt billionaire CEO. And currently, he's one of the few actors in history who can claim to appear simultaneously on three different TV series. He plays himself on HBO's comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm. He has a more prominent role as co-star on another HBO comedy series, Bored to Death. And this season, he's the new star of CSI Crime Scene Investigation on CBS, playing a forensics expert who seems to really enjoy his work, even at crime scenes.
Hey, thanks. Find the two missing rounds from the guard's gun yet?
Nope. I'm beginning to think they're in the next county. Warren Vinnie Sapphire.
All right, okay. The only blood out here is from the guard who was shot in the face with a .44. Two shooters inside had .38s.
Maybe whoever was driving Vinnie's getaway car was packing the .44. The guard shot the car twice.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, do me a favor. Shoot me in the face.
What?
Shoot me in the face. Pretend gun. You know, about a foot away, and don't miss.
You're the boss.
Bang, 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 bang.
Wasn't even ready.
That's the point. We're done here. You can wrap it up. Bullets aren't out here, and they're not in the next county, and they're not in Vinnie Sapphire, right? Or in his car. Hey, thank you. That was fun.
Even that character, though, isn't as loose as the one Ted Danson plays on Bored to Death, which began its new season this week on HBO. The series stars Jason Schwartzman as Jonathan, a writer who turns his love of hard-boiled detective novels into a second career, advertising on Craigslist as an unlicensed private eye. Ted Danson plays his magazine editor boss, George Christopher, who ends up tagging along with him on cases. Before we hear Terry's 2009 interview with Ted Danson, let's revisit this scene from the first episode. They're at a gallery opening when George, played by Danson, asks Jonathan, played by Jason Schwartzman, if he has any pot. He does, and so they go into the men's room. George is surprised to see that Jonathan is carrying his marijuana in a prescription pill bottle.
This is my Viagra bottle. What are you doing with marijuana in my Viagra bottle?
You gave me that bottle months ago. There were two pills left in it. You told me I should try them. Now I'm putting my pot in
it. Are you insane? What if you got arrested for marijuana possession? Page Six would have a field day. I can't have... Hello? Hello? I can't have the world knowing that I use Viagra.
Do you really need to take so much?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. My heart medicine and heavy drinking have taken a toll. I'm not what I once was. But I accept that. It's called humility.
Why are you back on pot?
Because I'm bored. Oh, God, I'm bored. Death by a thousand dull conversations. I don't know what's going on, but almost everybody has bad wine breath tonight. It's like Chernobyl out there.
Do you think we drink too much?
No, we don't drink too much. Men face reality, women don't. That's why men need to drink.
That's a line from my novel.
Yeah, well, you stole it from me.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, actually, you did.
Actually, no, I didn't.
Fine, Jonathan.
Anyway, Suzanne moved out today because she says I drink too much.
Well, I'm not surprised.
Why do you say that?
Because you're like me, Jonathan. We enthrall and then we disappoint.
You're getting to play much more varied characters than you did when you were younger and famous originally. Mm-hmm. Because people got so used to you as Sam Malone, the bartender on Cheers, who was the opposite of intellectual. And the power that he had was like the power in the bar. But now you're playing people who have like, you know, real power, who are kind of successful and also often like self-delusional and sometimes
yes,
with a little bit of an evil streak. And it's been really fun for me as a viewer to discover that side of you as an actor.
Fun for me, too. I have to admit, I think part of me thought I had stayed at the the half-hour comedy dance a bit too long, and I think part of me was going, wow, I'm not as funny as these other people who are coming up, and I was kind of boring myself in a way. And then Damages came along and really kind of turned things around for me.
Well, you mentioned Damages, so there's a perfect opportunity to play a scene from it. And Damages is an FX series starring Glenn Close as a lawyer. And in this, you play Arthur Frobisher, a billionaire CEO who cashed in his stocks, and then the company went under, leaving the employees without jobs or pensions. So they hired a lawyer, the Glenn Close character, to file a class action suit against you. You really want to save your reputation. So one of the things you've done is get a writer to write a book about you. But the writer has his own idea, and you know he wants to do some investigation, find out who you really are, what you've really done in your life, some of the bad things you've done in your life. You see this book as an opportunity to just like burnish your reputation and talk about like your ladder to success and overcoming the odds. So you show up very inappropriately at midnight, unannounced, at the writer's house.
And slightly drunk.
And slightly drunk with a whole box of like your trophies and your ribbons and memorabilia that's designed to show him what each of these things represent in your life and what you had to go through to achieve the success that each of these objects represent. So here's the scene.
No, see, look, this stuff, all this is my integrity. See what I'm saying? Here, look. Third prize, middle school spelling bee.
Great.
No, I'm dyslexic. Remember I told you that? So that's determination. Here, look. Yeah, all right, varsity. This is interesting. Varsity, that's the first time I realized that I was a natural leader.
Yeah, you know, all this stuff that you're giving me is great. Yeah. But this book...
All right, look. All right, here, come here. This shirt, right? Shirt you're wearing, you own other shirts, right? So if I come along and say, you know, define you as the guy who wears this shirt, I'd be wrong, right? Because you're not just one thing. See, that's what I'm trying to say. You're not just one thing. Hey, I told you, right, that I started off dirt poor.
You told me yesterday about that.
Well, why don't you write? See, all right, hey, listen. 17, I came this close to joining the army. Realize what that means?
Look, Mr. Frobisher, I haven't seen Indira for 2 weeks. She has been traveling, understand, and this is our night together. So we'll just cut it short.
Wait, all right, let's back up here. Tell me about your book.
My novel?
Sorry, your novel.
It's hard to describe.
Just tell me what it's about.
On the face of it, it's a love story. It's about nostalgia and how that affects our core relationships.
Jesus, George. I mean, that sounds like crap. Are you kidding me? Look what you're doing here. I mean, you're sleeping on a futon. Come on. I mean, you know, of course you're writing about my life. You don't have one, you know? And you're immigrant because what?
Excuse
me? You appreciate their culture. Excuse me? Is that what you're saying to yourself? Truth is, you're just trying to feel superior. Try running a $40 billion industry. See how that makes you feel.
Get out!
Yeah, try managing 11,000 employees.
Just leave!
You want to know why they're suing me, you invisible piece of because I'm worth it.
I hope that you lose everything.
Yeah, you be careful.
Because you are an arrogant.
Hey, guess what? You're fired.
And that punch was the sound of the Ted Danson character hitting the ghostwriter really hard, maybe breaking his nose. That's such a great scene.
With my little toy car.
That's right. I love the way you play that scene. There's a lot of words that you only like half say. It's almost like it's partly because you're drunk, but it's partly because like time is, you're so important and you have so little time, you don't even have to say the whole word, you know?
Cause
you've said that you worked with an acting coach before doing Damages, and I guess I'm wondering why you've acted for decades. Why did you feel the need to do that?
I did work with an acting coach right beforehand. His name's Harold Guskin. What he said to me was actually kind of exciting for me just as an actor, because I had been doing comedy half hour for so long, which has this rhythm to it. It's almost like doing a musical. There is a rhythm you need to adhere to, even if you disguise it. You know, there is a clean musical comedy energy to doing half hour. What he said to me was, you know, don't, you have four lines you're about to do. You have a paragraph in the script. Well, maybe you're going to say one line, maybe you'll say two, maybe you won't feel like saying the other lines, and maybe you won't. You're Arthur Frobisher. You'll do what you want when you want, and if you don't feel like, you know, you don't be the nice actor, don't give them what they want, do whatever you want. And he instilled this kind of creative arrogance in me that was the same arrogance of the character, the billionaire who doesn't really have to answer to anyone and can do whatever he wants because people love him because he's a billionaire. And it was really a great note to give me.
On HBO in the Larry David series, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you've played yourself, Ted Danson. And your wife, Mary Steenburgen, plays your wife and plays herself. So when you started on Curb Your Enthusiasm, how did you figure out who the Curb version of Ted Danson was going to be?
I think it's the same thing, even though you're playing yourself. You go, all right, what is my function here? My function is to be a foil for Larry David. My function is to set up roadblocks or do something that heighten what he's really funny at, you know, funny at. So it becomes, you shape yourself, even though your name's Ted Danson and you're married to Mary Steenburgen, but the truth is you are trying to do what's best in each scene to highlight Larry, which is why I hate Larry. I don't really like him. I'm tired of highlighting Larry. I'm glad you laughed, because he's one of our best friends, and we, you know, see him all the time socially, and he's lived in our guest house for two summers in a row. Mary calls him Larry the Lodger. He just won't leave.
So are there scenes in episodes of Curb that actually came out of your life or came out of your real relationship with Larry David?
Not necessarily, although when you go out to dinner with him, it's way scarier than acting with him, because he's always pulling out his notebook, or you don't know whether or not he's doing a scene in a restaurant and being a little louder than he should be because he's practicing something for next week, or whether this is truly Larry. It's a very scary kind of proposition, hanging out with Larry David.
I can imagine it would be a little embarrassing when he's talking too loud or doing something inappropriate, and you don't know whether he's testing a performance or just being weird.
We've sat in a restaurant, a very sweet, quiet inn, you know, New England inn, with a lot of people with kind of blue-gray hair, and he came in late, and his back was to the entire restaurant, but we were looking at the entire restaurant over his shoulder, and he was whispering this story in a kind of stage whisper that had the F word in it a lot, and he basically cleared the restaurant. And then as he's walking out, he went, "Nice restaurant. A little too quiet for a Jew, but it's a nice restaurant," and walked out. And it was like, and you kind of have to walk in his wake going, "Sorry, sorry, sorry. You know it's Larry. Sorry."
That sounds so much like it should be on Curb. And maybe
it
will
be. Yeah, and will be, right.
I want to play a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm. This is an episode in which you and your wife, Mary Steenburgen, have invited Larry David and his wife to a party. And he doesn't like parties. He doesn't want to go. So he comes.
This is real.
This is totally real. Great.
This summer, he would not go to people's homes for dinner. I'll go to a restaurant because then I can leave when I want. But at a home, I'm stuck. I don't want to come. And he made this a rule of thumb. Anyway, please go on.
Okay. So in this scene, he doesn't want to go to your party. So he comes up with this scheme that he'll pretend that he thought your party was really the next day. So the day after the party, he shows up at your door. And, you know, saying, "Oh, okay, we're here for the party." And he expects that you'll say, "Oh, it was last night," and then he could just go home. But that's not what happens. So here's the scene.
Hey!
Hey!
What you guys doing?
What's going on?
What do you mean?
Where is everybody?
You thought there was a party.
Oh, my God. You thought the party was tonight?
Yeah.
Last night. The party was last night.
Are you kidding me?
No, man.
That's unbelievable. What? We got the wrong night?
Yeah, you did.
Jesus Christ. Holy cow.
I was actually glad to hear this. I was a little pissed off that you didn't call.
Well, now you know why we didn't call.
Hey, Mary.
Of course we didn't call, because we're coming tonight.
Come on in.
Oh, no.
We're not going to come in.
No, come in.
We got the wrong night. It's our fault.
It doesn't matter.
Hey, Mary. We're right.
The party is tonight.
So stupid.
You're kidding.
Can you believe how stupid we are?
All right, it's good to see you guys. We'll call you later.
No way you're leaving. This is fantastic. We have so much leftover food. You're going to come in and help us eat it.
You know what? I'll call you tomorrow. Yeah. We'll get together. We'll do the
whole
thing.
Why?
I'll take you out to dinner. I'm paying.
Hey, Larry, you don't have any plans. You're supposed to be here, and you're here. Come on in. Come on, Cheryl. Be fun. Come on in. This will be fun. Hey, we got leftovers. Make an omelet or something. Come on.
Sure.
You guys.
Oh, yeah.
We can.
That'd
be great. Come on.
This is like pulling teeth. Come on in, you guys.
That's a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm with my guest, Ted Danson. So, did you get a script for that scene? Did Larry David tell you what it was about and then ask you to just improv your lines? How did it work?
What he does is he works for months on setting up the season, the arc of the season. Then each show is broken down into scenes. And this is pretty typical of a writing room for comedies. You break everything down beat by beat so that the last thing you do is you send a writer off to write the actual dialogue. He takes it right up to the dialogue. You know what he needs, but the words that come out of your mouth have not been written.
Now, you got your start on the TV series Cheers, which is one of the more famous TV series in TV history. Did you feel like you knew this character?
No, Lord, no. I didn't. I had no idea how unintelligent he was. At first, I thought he was making these, because Sam would come out with these things that were funny, and I thought, well, maybe he's being ironic. You know, maybe he's smart enough to know that he's saying stupid things. In the beginning, I think it took me about a year and a half before, maybe a season and a half before I had an inkling on how to play Sam Malone, because he was a relief pitcher, which comes with a certain amount of arrogance. You know, you only get called in when you're in trouble and you're there to save the day. And that takes a special kind of arrogance, I think. And Sam Malone had that arrogance, and I, Ted Danson, did not. I was nervous, scared, excited about, you know, grateful about my new job.
Well, let's hear a scene from season one, and we'll hear the kind of arrogance that you're talking about that your character...
Or lack of.
Lack of that your character, Sam Malone, had. So here's a scene with you and Shelley Long.
Why are you so upset?
You know... This week, I have gone out with all the women I know. I mean, all the women I really enjoyed. And all of a sudden, all I can think about is how stupid they are. I mean, my life isn't fun anymore. And it's because of you.
Because of me?
Yeah. You're a snob.
A snob?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you're a rapidly aging adolescent.
Well, I would rather be that than a snob.
And I would rather be a snob.
Well, good, because you are.
Sam, do yourself a favor. Go back to your tootsies and your rat parts. I'd hate to see the bowling alleys close on my account.
Hey, wait a minute. Are you saying that I'm too dumb to date smart women?
I'm saying that it would be very difficult for you. A really intelligent woman would see your line of BS a mile away.
You think so, huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, you know, I've never met an intelligent woman that I'd want to date.
On behalf of the intelligent women around the world, may I just say,
it's Ted Danson and Shelley Long. So Ted Danson, was that before you felt like you could pull off the arrogance of your character?
Yeah, actually it was. I can actually hear it in my voice, you know. I really, you know, I want to sing Shelley Long's praises. I think the first couple of years, Cheers became the hit that it was because I mean, everyone was good in it, and everyone went on to become brilliant in it. But I think Shelley and that character hadn't been seen for a while on TV, and I think she just did an absolute brilliant, brilliant job.
Was it hard to create a new life after Cheers?
Well, I had this great solution. I blew my private life up in such a, you know, disastrous way that leaving Cheers became secondary to kind of putting my private life back together. So to answer your question, not really. Not really. There was so much going on in my life, my personal life, that took my focus that, you know, it wasn't that hard. I mean, it was hard because I missed my friends. It was hard. But after 11 years, I think we all had been looking for an ending.
And let me just say, I think what you were alluding to before when you said after Cheers your life became public in a big way, I think you're referring to the relationship with Whoopi Goldberg and the whole Friars Club thing where there was a roast of Whoopi Goldberg and you worked out a sketch with her in which you appeared in blackface. And, like, boy, there were just, like, movie stars and politicians and columnists who were so upset and publicly spoke out against you for having done that. It must have been a horrible, a horrible moment.
It was, but I mean, it was of my making, so, you know, it was all on my head. It was definitely a graceless moment in my life. But I kept thinking, well, I have to go roast Whoopi Goldberg. We were no longer actually going together at that moment, and we had tried to back out of, you know, of doing this, and they said, no, you have to, contractually, you have to. And I thought, well, how am I going to roast Whoopi when all the tapes and videos I see of people are a Jewish person will be saying horrible things about the Jewish person they're roasting, but it's okay because the Jewish person being roasted is being roasted by Jewish people. Or, you know, the African-American is being roasted by an African-American. So how's, you know, the white kid going to be roasting and doing, you know, an outrageous job for this amazingly outrageous woman? So I thought, I know, I'm not a stand-up comic, but I am an actor. So I'll do a little performance theater. So that was my rationale. And it was clearly a non-press event, we were told. And within seconds, I realized, oh, wow. By the way, Whoopi knew about it and had kind of signed off on it and thought it was funny. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go for it. And it did offend some people. And sometimes, I'd have to say rightfully so. Other times, it was theater and it was done with love.
Do you feel like you walked away learning anything either about comedy or about race in America from that experience?
Well, yeah. The stupidity on my part, the lack of thought to stand up and go, I'm now going to do race material and think that it would not draw a lot of heat was stupid on my part. So what did I learn? You know, I learned that I was at a very adolescent point in my life where I thought, you know what, I can do whatever I want. It's okay. I did naively think, because I was told that there would be no press, so I thought, okay, this is a room full of people who get this kind of humor. I'll be all right. And that was stupid on my part. Everything is open to the press now.
You know what I found really interesting about what you just said? You were saying that, you know, that you think you were arrogant then, and you were telling us before that you didn't know how to be arrogant. Like you didn't have that arrogance, and you had to learn it to play Sam on Cheers. And you were telling us about the kind of arrogance that you needed to have for the part that you play on Damages. This is like billionaire CEO who's like very arrogant. And it's interesting, you're talking about this moment in your life where you were arrogant for real, you think, and you got really burned.
Yeah. You know, actually, what followed, a week later, I had a replay, because evidently I hadn't learned my lesson, where I was driving in a car up a hill, and it was rainy, and I was late, and it was driving a little faster than I should, and I could feel my tires start to skid a little bit, and I almost had this literal thought, maybe not quite, but it was like, Ted, you better slow down. The roads are wet. And I went, no, I'm all right. I can handle this. And it was that same kind of arrogance of the world saying, hey, there are rules. Don't break the rules. And I spun out and got hit by a pickup coming the other way and slammed into the side of the cliff. Luckily, didn't go off the other end, you know, the other side, which was a cliff. And I was taken out of my car on a board, and it was all very dramatic. And I was fine. The next day, I had a stiff neck, and that was it. But it was... And that was like the moment where I went, whew, wake up.
So what did you do after that, like, wake up moment? What did you change?
Then it was kind of personal, so I won't go into that.
No, it's fine.
It was ending things that I should have ended. It was, I really did actually take care of business. And about a month later, I met Mary. And I don't think that I would have even seen her or she would have even seen me if I hadn't, you know, woken up.
I'd like to talk about your childhood a little bit. I know you grew up near Flagstaff, Arizona. Your father was an archaeologist and he directed a museum. What kind of museum was it?
It was a natural history museum. Part of its mandate was to honor and stimulate the culture and the arts of the Hopi, Navajo, Zuni, and Pueblo Indians in the Four Corners area. So most of my friends growing up were the sons of Hopi and Navajo people who worked at the museum and or ranchers' sons and daughters. I had a really interesting, kind of idyllic, jump on horses and ride in any direction you want upbringing.
So did you grow up with aspects of Hopi culture that made an impression on you?
Yes, but, you know, I was madly running around playing and jumping on horses and you know, playing cowboys and Indians, which was really weird for us.
Oh, God, you play cowboys and Indians with real Indians.
Yeah, it was very strange. We'd all go off and see, you know, on Sunday we'd take our, you know, our quarter and go to the Orpheum Theater and watch a John Wayne movie and kind of laugh derisively when the Indians that were wearing bonnets, which clearly meant Plains Indians, and they were supposedly Apaches, and we'd mock and laugh them. And then when the cavalry would come and just beat the crap out of the Indians, we'd all be kind of still for a moment, not knowing how to handle this kind of moment of, oh, sorry. Sorry about this.
So when you played cowboys and Indians, were you like the victorious cowboy beaten up on the Indians?
No, we were always on the same side. No, these cowboys and Indians were on the same side. We were always playing, usually against imaginary enemies.
Well, Ted Danson, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ted Danson, speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. You can see him currently in two weekly TV series, CSI on CBS and Bored to Death on HBO. On October 23rd, our next guest, Will Ferrell, will receive the annual Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. The ceremony will be held at the Kennedy Center, and Conan O'Brien and Larry King will be among those paying tribute. The ceremony will be televised October 31st on PBS. Here's a clip from the 2004 movie Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, in which Will Ferrell plays the pompous title character, who also sees himself as a sort of rock star flute player.
Guys, East Harlem Shakedown, E flat. Keep the cymbal splashy, and Jerry, let's take the bass line for a walk. Hold on. I'm not hearing it right. Hold on. We got it now. It's all right. Little ham and eggs coming at you. Hold on, people. Hope you got your griddles. That's baby-making music. That's what that is.
Will Ferrell in a scene from the 2004 comedy Anchorman. Terry Gross spoke with him in 2006.
So when you went to, like, audition for Saturday Night Live, the story goes that you took a trunk of, like, a suitcase of Monopoly money with you so that you could do what?
Well, I had read somewhere that Adam Sandler had gone and had a meeting with Lorne Michaels and had gone into this meeting kind of sight unseen and had done this really funny bit and where he, I don't know, mimicked having sex with a chair or something and was hired on the spot. And I thought, well, I'm gonna follow that. Like, be funny in the room and kind of take advantage, you know, of the moment, to kind of seize the day type of attitude. So I thought what would be really funny is if I walk in with a briefcase full of toy money and just start piling it on his desk and say, Lauren, look, we can talk, you know, till the cows come home, but we really know what talks, and that's money. And I'm going to walk out of this room, and you can either take this money or leave it on your desk. I'll never know the difference. And hopefully he'd think it's funny that I stacked all this fake counterfeit money. But when I got in, the atmosphere was so intense that I never got to my big joke, and I just sat there with my briefcase in my lap. Which, when I left, it felt insane because I remember I was thinking, well, he must be thinking, what comedian walks in with a briefcase and just sits there nervously? And so I never. And then we had another meeting where I tried to do it again, and the assistant said, "Oh, leave your briefcase. You don't need that." And then that was, lo and behold, that was the meeting where he told me I had the job. And then as I left, I gave a handful of the fake money to the assistant. I was like, can you please give this to him? It's kind of symbolic. And I tried to do this twice, but I could never do it. So can you give him this fake money? And in hindsight, he thought it was really funny that I'd tried twice to do this gag, and it never kind of came to fruition.
One of the things you became famous for in Saturday Night Live was your impersonation of George W. Bush. And, of course, in 2000, the debates that you did with Daryl Hammond as Al Gore, I mean, became, like, really quite famous. Do you think that they influenced how people who watched the show actually thought of the candidates?
Yeah, I've been told as much that we actually – I mean, well, it was – you know, we had found out later that the Gore people showed the sketch, the first one we did, to the candidate and to the vice president to say, look, this is how you're perceived. And I guess we did. It was kind of a crazy time to have all eyes on us, you know, for that, in that moment.
Let's hear a short clip of you doing George W. Bush, and this is from Saturday Night Live. My guest is Will Ferrell.
The following is an address by the President of the United States.
Good evening, America. I'm very happy to be back in this country after my very successful trip in the Pacific Rim. I'm heartened to hear that, for the most part, the people of this country show strong support for my agenda. However, lately there are some who are beginning to criticize this administration. Maybe these people don't understand. America is presently at war, not just a war on terrorism, but we are engaged in a deadly standoff with an axis of evil. You know who I'm talking about. Iran, Iraq, and one of the Koreas. But my axis of evil doesn't seem to interest some people out there. Some people just want to talk about the economy and budgets and Enron. I bet most of you out there don't even understand Enron. I sure as heck don't.
That's Will Ferrell as George W. Bush. Did you ever get any feedback from President Bush about his thoughts on your impression of him?
No, I never got any direct feedback as far as I knew. We might have talked about this before, but I did. I met him once when he came to the show, and he didn't realize that I was the guy who played him, even though it was even though it was put to me that he was a huge fan. And so it was this very awkward situation where, and this was during the campaign of 2000, And so it was this whole thing of hurry, rush down to the studio. The governor really wants to meet you. And I'm like, okay. And then they forced me into this, you know, all these photographers, and they're like, go, say hi. And I could tell he had no idea that I was the guy. And so we just kind of stood there and, you know, had this awkward, like, he was like, pleased to meet you. And he just kind of looked at me, and then it kind of dawned on him that, I know who you are. And and then I had to go somewhere or something. But so it was kind of apropos, I think, in a way.
One of the impressions that you did on Saturday Night Live, one of the characters you did was James Lipton from the Actors Studio broadcast.
Yes.
That was always so much fun.
It was kind of amazing how much James Lipton loved the impression, so much so that he had me come on his 100th episode as him. And we did an interview back and forth where we he asked me questions, which was very surreal as he stood over my shoulder watching me get into makeup saying, "Yes, the transformation has begun. I'm watching you becoming me." And it was very... And he watched the whole 30 minutes it takes me to get in that makeup. And I was like, you can go get a sandwich if you want at some point, you know. And he was like, "No, this is fascinating." And but one of the many interesting things that has happened to me.
Did you notice things sitting across the table from him that you hadn't noticed watching on TV?
Not really. I don't know. I think if anything I noticed was I felt like, God, I think I slightly underplay him. I could go even bigger.
Let's actually hear you doing James Lipton on Saturday Night Live. So this is Will Ferrell.
On the 13th of January, 1931, right here in New York City, magic happened. An artist was born that would rival Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo. But his tools would not be pen, nor brush, nor chisel, nor palette. His tools would be his comically oversized glasses and his soul. So please, welcome the greatest performer ever to have graced this earth, Charles Nelson Reilly.
That's Will Ferrell doing James Lipton. And later in the sketch, Charles Nelson Reilly is played by Alec Baldwin. How do you study somebody like Lipton when you're doing an impersonation of him? Like, what is your process of watching somebody, whether it's Lipton or President Bush?
I usually have to just pick one key thing and then emphasize that again and again and again, and then hope that the rest kind of fills in. But with with Bush, I as I tried to work on him vocally, I really just worked on it more from the way he kind of scrunched up his face and kind of squinted his eyes and almost started from that approach. And with Lipton, I just tried to over enunciate.
What's the worst thing that actually did happen to you live on the air on Saturday Night Live?
The worst thing, I was doing an update feature, where on Weekend Update on the fake news section, you know, characters will sometimes come out, and my glasses started fogging up to where I couldn't read the cue cards, and then I started laughing. And it was this kind of this wonderful kind of crazy situation of I was having this laughing attack and I can't see anything. And I literally kind of had to just stop and wipe off my glasses and then get back to reading the cue cards. So it was actually kind of really fun free fall of like, oh, well, there's no way to rescue this. But the audience kind of loves it in a way when they're watching that happen.
So did you stay in character while you were wiping off your
glasses? Yeah, I did. It was I was I did this character who suffered from voice immodulation, which was someone who I only could speak like this. I had no control of the volume of my voice. So whether I was speaking intimately or shouting, it was the same voice level. So I would have asides to myself, like, boy, she doesn't smell very good. You know, so it would be, so I could never have a private moment, and that I was afflicted with this disease, and people didn't think it was a real disease, and I was the champion of this thing. It was very, it's bizarre.
Will Ferrell speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. This month, he receives the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. The 19th movie from the acclaimed Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar is called The Skin I Live In. It reunites him with actor Antonio Banderas, who first came to international attention as an obsessed gay lover in the director's 1987 film Law of Desire. This time, Banderas plays a mad scientist driven to replace his dead wife with another person who looks like her. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
At festivals and in interviews, Pedro Almodóvar is such a furry cuddle bear that it's possible to forget what a perverse filmmaker he can be. That is, until you watch something like his nasty new gender-bent Frankenstein picture, The Skin I Live In. It's a self-conscious, madly ambitious work, rife with allusions to countless other films. But does it have a soul? I couldn't detect one amid all its borrowed tropes. The movie centers on a Spanish plastic surgeon named Robert Legerde, played by Antonio Banderas, who's obsessed with creating a new kind of flesh. Early on, we learn his wife was badly burned in a car crash, and later, after seeing herself, jumped out a window. And that Legerde wants to make skin not only fireproof, but damn near impenetrable. It turns out that Legerde's philosophy of identity is literally skin deep. Our face, he lectures his colleagues, identifies us. Ergo, what's to stop him from putting his dead wife's on someone else and getting her back? Certainly it won't be his moral sense. Nothing will keep him from experimenting on living things. Without seeing The Skin I Live In, film buffs will pick up allusions to Frankenstein, Hitchcock's Vertigo, Georges Franju's Eyes Without a Face, and Michael Powell's Peeping Tom, along with Pygmalion, and one or two Italian horror pictures featuring mad scientists and their imperious female housekeepers imprisoning young women for nefarious experiments. Legerde has, in fact, a patient locked in a room full of surveillance cameras. She's a beautiful young woman named Vera, played by Elena Anaya, first seen doing yoga in a flesh-colored bodysuit so tight it's like a second layer of you-know-what. Where did she come from? Why does she resemble the doctor's late wife? The Skin I Live In is a puzzle movie, and I don't want to orient you any more than I already have. It features long, digressive subplots, some of which center on a thug in a tiger costume who has some relationship to Legerde and his housekeeper. After about an hour, Almodóvar gets around to the flashbacks that orient us, until the narrative stands revealed as a fairly standard revenge saga. But beneath that narrative is a meditation on seeing, on the tension between our inner and outer lives, and perhaps our inner and outer gender identities. The movie has enough disfigurement, torture, and kink to make it a hit with the art house crowd that wants its own version of the gut bucket sensation The Human Centipede and its new sequel. It has a surface brilliance, especially in the giant, obscenely fleshy paintings on Legerde's walls, which connect with the way in which he studies his prisoner Vera's derriere. But this is the only Almodóvar movie in which emotion doesn't suffuse the imagery and hold the ramshackle melodrama together. What you get is what you see. Almodóvar apparently worked to deaden Banderas' demeanor, saying evil people have an absence of empathy, an absence of self-awareness, an overriding absence. But I worry that Almodóvar has made himself absent, too. His movies have always been rife with allusions, but there was an emotional purity to them, as if the films this lonely young gay man consumed in the last years of Franco's Spain had fused with his DNA and become a part of him. His own early films were campy but sincere, defiantly sexual, and effeminate in a culture that had until then been macho and fascistic. It's been more than 35 years since those first films, and slowly, Almodovar the transgressive has morphed into Almodovar the formalist. Perhaps The Skin I Live In is an attempt by the director to question the depth of his own artistry by making the very look of his work suspect. But it lacks the one thing that would turn this from a sterile exercise into a true cry from the heart: emotional clarity.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hersfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.